Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, August 27th, Joe was joined by Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, Professor Emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University, and author of A Liberal Vanguard, Populist Elitism in the United States and Russia, Alexander Mihailovich, and Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan.
From the Washington Post, which they have established and labeled as breaking news, but D.C. judges and grand jurors are pushing back on Trump policing surge. This, of course, dealing with the story coming out of the District of Columbia, as well as the, I'll say the word, threat to other cities to have the National Guard move in. A federal magistrate judge said one arrest in D.C. was preceded by, quote, the most illegal search I've seen in my life. In another case, a grand jury refused three times to issue an indictment against a woman accused of assaulting a federal officer. These are all stories coming out of what is happening in Washington, D.C. Trump declared a crime emergency this month, giving federal law enforcement agencies and National Guard members unprecedented authority to patrol the nation's capital while also enlisting the district's 3,100-member police force to assist with immigration enforcement. More than 1,000 arrests have followed, according to the White House. Meanwhile, D.C.'s top prosecutor, Jeanine Pirro, ordered her staff to file the stiffest possible charges in every case. And this...
Just like her drinks.
This... This reporting, it was a low blow, but I'll allow. This reporting from the Washington Post. But there are emerging signs that not all of the arrests will stand up to scrutiny in court. A federal grand jury on three separate occasions this month refused to indict a D.C. woman who was accused of assaulting an FBI agent. An extraordinary rejection of the prosecution's case. Days later, a federal magistrate judge said an arrest in Northeast Washington was preceded by the most illegal search I've seen in my life and described another arrest as lacking, quote, basic human dignity. While judges are known to criticize prosecutors from time to time, grand jurors only in rare cases refuse to issue an indictment, which requires them to find only probable cause that a crime was committed, the lowest evidentiary bar in the legal system. Instances of failed indictments have begun to crop up more since Trump took office this year. Grand jurors in Los Angeles have rejected indictments of people who were arrested for protesting the administration's immigration enforcement actions, that according to the Los Angeles Times. The July 22nd scuffle at issue in D.C. federal court occurred weeks before Trump's law enforcement order, but the grand jurors were presented with the case this month just as federal agents were descending on Washington. Prosecutors alleged that Sidney Reed was obstructing and recording agents from the FBI and U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement as they attempted to arrest a gang member being released from the D.C. jail who was slated for deportation. An FBI agent scraped her hand against a wall amid the fracas. And prosecutors plan to charge Reed with assaulting, resisting, or impeding a federal officer, a felony offense punishable by up to 8 years in prison. The stories can go on and on, but under the Fifth Amendment, charges that carry potential penalties of more than a year in prison must be approved by at least 12 members of a grand jury. Where does this bring us, do you think, Mayor, especially as we're talking about the president is talking about expanding this program?
I think that it should give everyone in this country pause. We have civilian police forces that have protected our communities for centuries. very different than an occupying force of National Guard, and very different training that one receives in the FBI. Mm-hmm. So there is a huge difference between your civilian police report force, over which ultimately the people have a voice, right? They elect mayors, mayors appoint police chiefs. And so there's a local accountability that we've experienced here in Albany when people have not liked the way that the police have responded. And so we have, for example, in the city of Albany, a civilian police review board. We have an advisory committee that advises the police department, but every locality is different. But I think it's really important for people to understand that the National Guard is not trained to police. They are not trained on this to the same degree as police officers are on things like de-escalation, constitutional rights, search and seizure. Those are not things that are part of the training that these individuals receive. They're trained to go in and stabilize, occupy. But that one-on-one engagement of arresting individuals, of policing, is a very different job. And I think it's really important that we recognize that this is not the path that we want to go down unless people truly believe that we should live in a military dictatorship.
It does seem, Bob Griffin, that every day there is something that ups the ante, and that there is another action that is mentioned by the administration that will further and make this, well, I would say more onerous, but will certainly heighten it. Yesterday, during the power hours of the cabinet meeting, which we'll talk about, Trump called for the death penalty in all D.C. Murder cases. Now, it's not at all clear how the president could carry out such a directive, but the Supreme Court ruled that mandatory death sentences were unconstitutional about a half century ago. And yet, this is again upping the ante.
It is, Joe, and... You know, I view it as this is red meat for the base. I think that you see these increasingly absurd and authoritarian movements by Trump as you start to see his poll numbers continuing to decline. You see even members of his base starting to question things like the Epstein files and what his administration is doing as far as the public release of documents. You're seeing the tariffs really starting to chew into the economy. You see a general malaise on this country. The truth of the matter is that this administration has been an abject failure so far. And the cracks are really starting to show. And the way he's papering over the cracks in his policies and administration is by pushing the envelope on areas in an attempt to draw attention away from others. The other part of this that I think is that would be remiss if we don't talk about, he's already gearing up. Trump is already gearing up for the midterm elections. Mm-hmm. He can't run on the economy. He can't run on our international prestige. He can't run on his failed foreign policies in achieving peace anywhere in the globe. He's gonna count on crime. So he's creating these myths about the how foul the blue state or democratic controlled cities are, that they're truly just crime ridden, and that we have to send the military in as a way of trying to reshape the whole narrative on what is going on in the economy and what's going on in the country. The mayor raises, I think, some really interesting questions that we should talk about. Like, okay, where is the line that we want as a people between our civil liberties, our capacity to live, and our capacity to live safely? I've said multiple times on the show, I don't trust the government, and this is someone who has worked in government for close to 40 years. And I think it's part of our patriotic responsibility to question government. But now I'm questioning the military. Now I'm questioning law enforcement. And again, all of these actions begin to have a significant fraying of the social compact between me as a citizen and the government, particularly the enforcement arms. I think Tamir is absolutely correct. The military was never designed to do law enforcement. In fact, you know, if you go back to Posse Comitatus, but also you start to think about the basic training that goes on. In fact, one of the biggest criticisms internationally of our military is that they're wonderful at winning wars, right? You know, destroying tanks and critical infrastructure. They're absolutely abysmal at state building, as we've seen in places like Afghanistan. And yet, all of a sudden, we're going to try to expand the militarized presence of this quasi military in ICE and its allies in law enforcement into only blue cities. And as I said last week on the show, Joe, it's interesting to me that if you look at the murder rates in D.C. versus Memphis, which is higher, right. New Orleans, which is higher, you know, these red states, both of whom governors have sent National Guards troops to D.C. when their own cities have higher murder rates. Mm-hmm. It shows the partisan the partisan bend of this, which is really terrifying, because I mean he's making no bones about it that he will target Democratic leaning states and jurisdictions in the most partisan way that I've ever seen in my career.
Well, in addition, all of the data that I've seen out there shows that the murder rate is lower in states with no deaths. Penalty than it is in states that have death penalties.
There's no correlation at all between death penalty and the other. The other part of it that I personally believe, and I'm interested for the panel to talk about this if they think I'm right or wrong. I also think what this is doing is that he's trying to head off protests that he knows his policies are unpopular. I mean, he knows that the big beautiful bill is generally despised across the country. And that as the economy continues to fray, at the same time we're going to start to see and feel the impacts of cutbacks in the social safety nets, people's ability and willingness to go to the streets is going to be different when you're looking at masked armed thugs.
I mean, I think another aspect of this is what seems to me is that Trump's administration is plugging into a very specific school of conservatism that is largely not a part of American conservatism, which is the fetishization, idolatry of the state. This really struck me in Trump 1 when Stephen Miller, very early on in that administration, said this was in regard to a disagreement between Congress and Trump. I can't remember which exact law Trump wanted to push through, but he wasn't able to push it through it. But Miller said the will of the president will be obeyed. And as somebody who comes from an immigrant background from Eastern Europe, this struck me as being very resonant with a particular kind of, I don't know what you would call it, a European tradition of hardcore conservatism, where the state, the government, is actually your friend. And this is largely, a notion, a belief, which really runs against the grain of any number of different American conservative traditions, whatever one might think of them. Certainly libertarianism is one of those, you know. Now the state is something that, we should enlist as our ally. The state should take over business. The state should take over institutions. And we see this across the board in terms of any number of different American conservative, I would say, religious movements are now very friendly to this idea. For example, the New Apostolic Reformation among some Protestant groups, they want the state to become fully entrenched as a kind of a Christian institution with multiple arms. And again, this was largely not even the moral majority under Reagan and Jerry Falwell encouraged this kind of expansive understanding of the American government as something that should get involved in sort of the grassroots of how we conduct our daily lives.
But it's so focused on Trump.
Yeah.
So Trump spent all of his campaign telling us that we couldn't trust government, that it was wasteful, that it was infested with, you know, woke ideology. Mm. It was not something to be trusted. Mm. And now it is. But now that I'm in charge, I am going to make government ubiquitous.
Yeah.
And the federal government is going to decide these very hyper-local issues that most Americans, I do believe, support being hyper-local. Mm. People want to decide these things for themselves and for their communities. And so it is a very, I think, dangerous path that we're on. And as we look at what's happening next year and the midterms and the facts that in many instances, we don't have confidence that the court's going to step in. Mm. I mean, you talk about the institutions. This is a full government takeover of everything from the Smithsonian institutions to the Congressional Library to your local police department. Mm. And that is the path that we are on, and I think it's very intentional. And it is the ultimate aim that Trump has. He wants to be in charge.
It's very strange, though, because if you're asserting this level of control at both the federal, state, and local level, this requires a metastasis of any number of different bureaucratic organizations and entities and categories. This is going to explode government. It is not going to slim it down. If you're serious about this kind of thing, and sometimes I wonder, maybe they aren't, because if you want to slim down the government, but you're also saying you want to have more control over, you know, cultural institutions and other kinds of institutions, this you need a kind of enormous footprint in terms of funding, it seems to me.
But he's fine with funding government. I mean, look at what they did with ICE. You know, ICE's budget has now increased to it would be in the top 20 militaries of the world just for ICE.
Right.
And he's cutting back on things that frankly he doesn't care about. I mean, he doesn't care about libraries. He doesn't care about culture. He's certainly not worried about going hungry. His grandkids or kids starving. I mean, so all of these, you know, all of these issues, he's fine in growing government. And I view this as, this is the ultimate power grab, because if midterms go the way I hope midterms go, the very first thing a new Congress is going to do is going to end his use of emergency powers and executive orders to rule by fiat, which is pretty much what he's doing right now. You know, the idea of signing an executive order that somehow creates a law about banning flag burning. I mean, where is Congress? And you know, I think, you know, I have said it multiple times on the show. I mean, where, you know, for the congressional members in the jurisdictions that are listening in right now that we broadcast to, every member of Congress should be stepping up and saying that's not acceptable.
But they're terrified, and if
you're that terrified, then get the heck out of the way.
But I don't see that happening. I mean, you have an individual who has 34 felony convictions saying he has the authority to fire a Fed governor because there's a whisper that she might have done something wrong. Mm. Right. So this is, I mean, this is what he did with Zelensky. You know, it's what he did with the Russians. Like, I want people who will dig up dirt on my enemies, on people that I want to get rid of, they will curry favor with me. They've eliminated what the estimate is now 300,000 positions in the government that he wants to fill with those who will do his bidding. And so, you know, I think he is sending a message, and you know, there are people fighting back, but I don't know what's going to happen to Lisa Cook when this ultimately gets to the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. They've given this president great latitude, and they gave him great latitude in their decision that gives him immunity.
Yeah.
And so he can bring in a whole group of people and say, break the law. Not, hey, I want to go up to the line, right? I really want to go hard on this, which some leaders do, but don't cross the line. This is a guy who's like, cross the line and I'll pardon you.
That was Kathy Sheehan on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, August 27th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, August 28th, Joe was joined by Publisher Emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, and Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pondicio.
I do want to just mention there, I don't think there is a lot to say here other than to talk about it. We brought it up on yesterday's program as it was unfolding, and that is that two children were killed, 17 people injured at a Minneapolis Catholic school. This happened yesterday morning. The children filed into the pews of the Annunciation Catholic Church on Wednesday morning for their first Mass of the new school year. Just minutes into the service, as the students were reciting Psalm 139, a call and answer prayer about God's all-knowing love, the sound of gunfire ripped through the air and the church windows shattered. In an instant, the back-to-school glee dissolved into terror and chaos. The and then the shooter was killed a short time later after this. That shooter, the assailant, later identified as 23-year-old Robin Westman, had stood outside the brown brick church on the city's southwest side and aimed a rifle through the glass at the young worshipers within. The shooter again killed two children ages 8 and 10, injured 14 more before dying of a self-inflicted gunshot wound in the parking lot. Three elderly parishioners were also wounded. The attack took place steps away from the church's affiliated school, which enrolls students from preschool through eighth grade. It was the nation's first school shooting since the end of summer break, expanding the list of communities to suffer from a uniquely American epidemic just 3 days into the Annunciation's fall semester. Parents, priests, and local leaders struggled to articulate the anguish they felt from such violence, piercing a place they held sacred, a place that as a school and a church they saw as a refuge. For Minneapolis, the pain echoed the trauma felt only 2 months ago when a gunman targeted two state lawmakers in their homes, killing Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband and injuring a colleague and his wife. The shooting began about 8:30 after Westman approached the house of worship armed with a rifle plus a shotgun and a pistol within seconds as bullets sprayed, teachers ducked their students behind the sanctuary's wooden pews, shielding them from fire. Robert?
Wow. I'm not comfortable talking about this, I'll be honest with you, Joe. For any number of reasons. One, you know, I'm an educator, so I work in schools, I work with children, so this kind of thing hits home. Two, I just despair of having a fruitful conversation about it. You know, in other words, whenever something like this happens, and I don't advise anybody to do this, if you look at social media, the instant reaction is, you know, whose team is going to take advantage of this? You know, who's to blame for this? What narrative does this support that I support? Look, the kids are not all right. Okay, that's the bottom line here. We have a mental health crisis in this country. It is getting worse, not better. You know, you want to talk about guns, we can talk about guns. I want to talk about mental health. It is beyond contradiction at this point to say anything other than we have a real crisis with young people who are disconnected, who are acting out their grudges fatally. And if we're going to have a conversation about events like this, let us please try to make those conversations productive and helpful, and not turn them into the usual parade of confirmation bias and finger-pointing.
Yeah, I'm going to go with my original reaction to this, which is I'm just angry. I mean, why this keeps happening? We're not doing anything about it. You know, you pass a red flag laws. Well, Minnesota has a red flag law. That didn't help. We need to do something constructive to address this. I mean, I thought Sandy Hook would have been, you know, the case. But, you know, kindergartners shot. Now we have kids in pews praying, shot from outside. It's not like you could have hardened that church because this person was shooting from the outside. We need to do something. And it's not, you know, there are a lot of people with mental health problems that don't shoot up, you know, churches full of, you know, 80-year-olds and, you know, kids that are K through 8, I think it was. This is, and it's more than they, you know, let's talk about, you know, two children were killed, 14 others were injured. I mean, oftentimes we just talk in terms of fatalities. Let's talk about the injuries children sustain, both physical and mental, when they go through something like this. The whole community is suffering and going through a trauma. You know, is it worth it to us as a society to be this violent, to allow this level of chaos happen? I mean, there is no excuse for this. Let's be angry about this and let the anger let us move to a constructive solution.
Yeah, you know, Joe, as I'm driving up this morning, when I, as I typically do when I come on the program, I try to, in the hour that I'm in the car, I go over in my head some of the topics that Joe has proposed we're going to be talking about, and I want to come up with something clever or different or unique or incisive. And I just find
you workshop your material.
Yeah, I workshop. I talk to myself. Nobody argues with me, but. It just every time I've been on the day after one of these things happened, and there have been at least several, and they happen many more times when I'm not around, the rhetoric that is well-meaning and thoughtful from all of the people who we interact with is the same, whether it's guns, whether it's mental health. I don't know at what point in time we should be raising the white flag. You wonder if it's ever going to change. We certainly can hope. The guns issue in this particular case, as far as I know from what I read, the guns were purchased legally. So then that checked that box off. Then the question is mental health. And by definition, if somebody is going to take a gun and shoot into a church, they've got to be mentally ill. Although we've had arguments from readers or listeners who've written in from time to time, don't like to make the connection if you say something like, "Oh, those people are crazy." Well, then crazy is not the word you're supposed to use. So the only thing that I was I was struck by the passionate comments of the mayor of Minneapolis, who said what I, among I hope many others, would say was, and I'm paraphrasing, "I don't want to hear about your thoughts and prayers. These kids were in church praying, and still it happened to what happened." So that drive up where I was going to find something incisive to say, it didn't work.
But I would disagree with you on that. I think it did work. But the mayor also took the opportunity. Robert, you mentioned this, that, you know, it seems that most of these things people just wait for a little information, and once they have it, the various camps seize on that information, and then it's manipulated into the story. In this particular case, it became that that Westman, who was the attacker here, was born Robert, changed their name to Robin and identified as female and wanted her name to reflect that identification. So quickly, some conservative activists seized on the shooter's gender identity to portray transgender people as violent or mentally ill. The mayor took exception to that immediately, saying that the trans community should not be villainized for this particular attack and the actions of this particular person. So once again, it becomes complicated by the facts and by what we know. But regardless, you leave a city fairly traumatized.
Right. And I think the media and the city officials involved handled the trans issue responsibly. In fact, I had to search. I heard the reference to the trans criticism. I had to search online to find this, you know, conservative criticism and allegations that it had something to do with this person transitioning. You know, the bottom line is there's really no the motive. There's no, you know, this person was mad at the world. They were mad at, you know, they were just spewing hate. We always try to struggle to find a reason. If we can find the reason this happened, that, you know, maybe we can prevent this from happening going forward. I think we have made some progress as a society in helping people identify people who might do this and try to get to intervene. There's some progress being made about that since, well, we've been dealing with this forever, but especially since Columbine. So I think that we as a society are doing better in terms of at least identifying it. Hey, and the one thing is, during COVID, we didn't have any school shootings.
Didn't have any what?
School shootings.
Because nobody was in school.
Nobody was in school. It was one good thing.
But, you know, and the other thing that struck me, and these are one of these things that you read, and I don't know enough about it. Like, I try to find enough as to how this works. But the FBI announced that they were investigating the crime as an anti-Catholic hate crime.
I think that's because there is a manifesto that this person left behind.
Right.
And it was, I saw it, I didn't read it.
It was taken
off of YouTube almost instantly, but, you know, for good or for ill, you can find it if you're looking for it. And also there were any number of angry and frankly incoherent messages scrawled on the weapons and the
cartridges themselves.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know how seriously to take that. I'm not a mental health expert, but I think that's the source of that, Joe.
Yeah, anti-Semitic writings on the gun as well, and a fascination with past serial killer, mass shooting assailants.
Yeah.
So, is that Christian or is that anti-Catholic?
I didn't see any anti-Christian things on the gun.
I didn't make an exhaustive study.
We have hundreds of millions of people in this country. And you've got yesterday a shooting at a Catholic school. You've got the shoot, the black church. Was it in Charlottesville where the church was? Well, at any rate, there was a shooting in a church. There was a shooting famously in the synagogue in Pittsburgh. There's the pattern is not necessarily which religion. The pattern is that somebody was mentally ill enough to get guns and shoot people.
I think that's right.
And with that many millions of people, again, I don't want to wave the white flag, but it's hard not to be demoralized and say it's never going to be changed. So just watch your back.
Well, I also, I mean, if I can amplify or add on to your point, Ira, I think It's dangerous work to try to add coherence to mental illness.
Yeah.
Right. Yes. So, which is why those messages tend not to interest me that much.
Exactly. Because you're reading into something of someone who is mentally ill, and that's
And in the previous segment, I was lamenting the politicization of public health. I'll double down on that here. The politicization of violence. I have no patience for it.
But what we need at this point is leadership. I think this is a problem. We can't just wave the white flag. We need to address this problem because our children are still going to school. People are still going to the movies. They're going they're going to concerts. I mean, this is not something we can just give up on.
Well, I'll also put in a plug for parenting as well. I mean, you know, red flag laws, I think, are a good idea. It seems inconceivable to me that someone didn't see something. You know, it's especially those of us who work with children. I was a teacher for quite a while. It's not a mystery when a kid is struggling. They have a hard time hiding it. So it seems, and again, I don't want to point fingers, but it seems unlikely that a person can be in this level of distress, and say what you will about the transgender issue and gender dysphoria. Clearly, this is a person who has had attention for struggles over the years. So it seems inconceivable to me that you could have this level of anguish in your life and no responsible adult sees it and raises a red flag.
I will note as investigators search for a motive. The mother of Westman
worked in the church.
Worked as a secretary of the church until 2021. But in one of those writings, said that maybe I could attack an event at the on-site church. And I do agree with Robert, that looking at that material is the manifesto and such, while you think it may give you an insight, is just loudly disturbing.
The insight I want is, why didn't anyone see this? Why didn't anyone know this? Why didn't anyone say something?
Right, especially when it is broadcast in some way, shape, or form on other on social media.
It's
going out into the world to someone, however limited that audience is.
You know, there's some discussion in the media about how we cover these. I mean, one of the things we do is we try to not to put too much focus on the assailant because we don't want to glorify.
Don't
mention their name. Don't mention, you know. But also, the other thing we do is we downplay the horrific violence involved. I mean, we saw this yesterday where, you know, the people who were involved didn't really want to get into great detail about how horrific it is when a little kid gets shot. And maybe if we did see some of that or did hear more of these details, maybe we would be a little bit more angry and take a little bit more constructive action to address this problem. I think it's not that we're sugarcoating it, but we're not giving the American public a true picture of just how bloody, how horrific, how heartbreakingly horrible these shootings can be. So, and by doing that, by covering up and not being blunt about it, we are letting the problem continue.
Yeah, I'm not sure that anger is, with respect, I respect your anger, which obviously is earnest, Judy. This drains me of anger, and I think my impulse does not go to anger, it goes to empathy. There are people out there who are struggling, especially children. We need to be aware, and we need to be involved with them.
That was Robert Pondicio on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, August 28th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, August 29th, Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, former EPA regional administrator, professor at Bennington College, and president of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck. A writer and analyst, he recently retired from the presidency of Siena University and was a former New York congressman. His new book is The Spirit of Philadelphia, Chris Gibson. And former vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick.
So the story, Trump targets agencies long seen as above politics, critics see big risks. And what I like about this particular story is it kind of puts several stories together and I think gives it a certain context, which I believe these are all stories that we have tackled individually. And this gives us an opportunity to look at them as a trend and see what is happening here. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has long been the place Americans turn to for data-driven information to help make health decisions. The Bureau of Labor Statistics was the source of nonpartisan jobs numbers by which Americans could judge the status of the economy. And the Federal Reserve was the independent central bank that often bucked the short-term demands of presidents with an eye toward the country's long-term economic health. Now, the independence of each of these American institutions is in question after President Trump and a push to root out pockets of independence of government has fired or taken steps to fire the leaders of those agencies and or bureaus. In doing so, critics say the Trump administration is risking the credibility of agencies that were long respected as above politics and play a vital role in providing information needed to guide major decisions about the nation's course. These places are not supposed to be partisan, said Chris Edelson, an assistant professor of government at American University. The biggest danger is the institution loses credibility and people cannot count on it. In a span of a few weeks, Mr. Trump has fired the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics after a less than flattering jobs report. By the way, the woman who was fired from the Bureau of Labor Statistics is going to be speaking, I believe, the week after next at Bard College.
Oh.
So if you get a chance to catch that, that will be very, very interesting.
Suddenly, we are all riveted by the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Yeah,
and I am now.
Well, I think she has a pretty cool story to tell.
Bard.
Has sought to remove a Federal Reserve Board governor amid a push to gain control of the board and has backed his health secretary's decision to dismiss the director of the CDC over vaccine policies. And we talked about Susan Monterez yesterday, the CDC director, who says she was targeted after she refused to, quote, rubber stamp unscientific, reckless directives. Teresa, would you like to begin?
I want to hear Chris on this.
Okay, Chris, go ahead.
Well, it's interesting you're going to have me lead off here because I actually have a broader perspective on this, having just finished this research project. And to me, what really resonates is power. And, you know, what I've learned going back to all the founding documents and also reading about the philosophers who influenced our founders and then tracing the America's history, our story, if you will, told through the history of ideas, you see a change. In the late 19th century, you see the ether being impacted by new, different ideas coming by way of Europe. This is Hegel. And others and really manifesting in Max Weber, who talks about how bureaucracy is going to help perfect man. And all of this ultimately does impact us here in this country. Woodrow Wilson becomes president. We start to see policy changes. And we move away from a founding idea, which was as human nature was very conflicted. Well, yeah, we have amazing abilities and capabilities, possibilities as humans, extraordinary love, sacrifice if we're called to it. But if we're being very candid, founders certainly felt this, is that we were very conflicted. And therefore, with that conclusion of human nature, we needed to treat power in a certain way. We needed to, wherever we could, decentralize. We needed to separate power, keep it checked, accountable, and transparency was a key piece on this. So, but then in the late 19th century, there is the belief that actually the founders got it precisely wrong. Woodrow Wilson writes this in his dissertation. He says, look, we've really encumbered ourselves. We've done this. We've tied our hands. We have so much possibility if we just take down the separation of powers. His dissertation is called Congressional Government. He envisions something similar to what's going on in Great Britain. All of this starts a path that has really been really unaltered. This arc has been unaltered for the last 125 years. Now, there were moments when we more enthusiastically and more comprehensively embrace this. But here we are today in 2025. I mean, generally speaking, before this era for President Trump, I mean, generally speaking, Republicans, at least some, had principled objections to this, you know, the idea that power should be separated and checked. But that's not where we are today in 2025. I mean, we have really both political parties are not really and this is not meant to be a judgment, but it is just a matter of fact, is both parties actually, for different reasons, do want to consolidate power. I mean, they progressives generally have a idealistic view of human nature that, you know, we can get so much more done, that they tend to agree with Wilson, what he said. And then populists actually don't have a principled position on power. That, again, that's not meant to be normative. That's not meant to be a judgment, just a statement of fact. Because what populists say is it depends. If you envision this kind of power that's been exercised in the last year and being done by somebody like President Obama, well, the right-wing populists say, no, no way. But if you're giving this kind of power to somebody, well, like they trust in President Trump, well, then they say yes. And of course, there are complications and implications when you don't govern by principle, if you govern by personality. So, you know, here we are today and we're talking about these firings and whatnot. And to me, what's really resonating from my research, from my book, The Spirit of Philadelphia, is that we need to rebalance power. I mean, there's ways Congress can do this. Actually, the founders gave Congress pride of place. They're Article I in the Constitution, and they can start by actually sunsetting emergency clauses. I had students ask me explicitly, how is it we read the Constitution? How is President Trump doing this on tariffs? I mean, facially in the Constitution, Article I, Section 8 explicitly gives this power to the people's representatives, to Congress. So how is this happening? And I have to actually explain to them that it actually came from initially law in 1917, backed up by 1977, that was then supported by case law that allowed in emergency circumstances for the president to actually assume these powers. And here we are today in 2025. Do we really think we're in some kind of emergency where this shouldn't be worked through and done in collaboration with the people's representative? So we can sunset laws, we can pass new laws that balance power, but ultimately, you know, this is what I see here today, is you got a country so divided that we're not looking at it in the broader perspective. We just say, are you pro-Trump or are you anti-Trump? And then you just sort of separate into your corner and you take your position. I think we need a complete reset and a recognition that those founding principles, and it's not about going back. On the last point, I know I need to yield here, but this is not about going back. It's about actually recovering time-tested principles so that we can go forward together.
But this Congress is not going to exercise any authority. On the drive-in, I happened to listen to Speaker Mike Johnson being interviewed on CNN. And my goodness, talk about not a leader. It sounded like he was just speaking, assuming that Donald Trump was listening to him. And he was asked key questions. The interviewer was great. His district has Shreveport, Louisiana, which has a much higher crime rate than Washington, D.C. And he was asked, you know, do you support sending the National Guard into your community? Oh, that's not my call. And then, oh, it's a Democratic DA. You know, no one wants to hear that. If you've got high crime rate, what is your your strategy to deal with it. Question after question, oh, that's not me. And then he would pepper in, you know, just praises to dear leader. Chris, I think what you're saying is interesting, important, it's historic, but the moment we are in is just so bizarre. And I think it reminds all of us how fragile our democratic institutions are. And just a few days ago, President Trump said he's president, he can do anything. I think he believes that. I don't think the congressional majority is going to step in. The courts have been doing some really interesting work. But then if it gets to the Supreme Court, I mean, that is incredibly divided. And I think the question is power to what end? And I think it's kind of obvious that Trump and his family are exercising power for their own economic gain and not in the public interest whatsoever.
And I really think this is, you know, there are, when you're talking about power, there's rights and responsibilities, right? And that it, when you, it, the question is who you put power in the hands of and what they do with it. And I think what's happening now is you have Russ Vought, and there's two tracks of things that are happening. You have Russ Vought and the Project 2025 Heritage Foundation, but it's really an amalgam of
and
groups.
And Vought is been, now the head of...
I'm sorry, he's the head of the Office of Management and Budget, but he had been a leader in Project 2025, and there were a whole host of, you know, alphabet soup of public far-right public policy groups who have for a long time put together this effort that will essentially disassemble the infrastructure of our government. And he will say, as will Stephen Miller, who is the president's chief of, what's, I don't know the title.
Destroying play. People. And
right-hand man, right. And also had operated at the fringes in the House and Senate
it's
before.
It's not the title, is it?
No. But really...
Deputy
what,
Chief. Yeah.
Deputy Chief. I'm not being disrespectful. I don't
remember.
No, I
remember think it's Deputy Chief of Staff.
Chief of Staff. I don't remember what...
I'm a resident racist.
Deputy Chief of Staff. We'll
Thank
go
you
with.
Very much.
Okay, go ahead.
We'll go with that. But what they are trying to do and have wanted to do for a long time is really test the limits of power within the government. And they found in Trump a person who would do that because, as Judith points out, he has his own track about power and how he can amass power to help himself and his enrich himself and his friends. And it's a really toxic combination, I think, and made so. But it's they are testing the limits. But the part of our system that is not working is the Article One part, as you say, Chris. The Republicans in the Senate are not, and it only requires 4 or 5 in the House and 4 or 5 in the Senate to do this. They are not asserting their Article One powers. That all sounds very fancy. They're not doing their job by saying that, you know, we have in our Constitution, our structure of government that's worked for a long time, a check and balance on this untethered. And so all of those big fancy words, what it boils down to is then at the Fed, if you do fire the Fed chief, all the experts that I read say this has global impacts and you're going to destabilize the dollar around the world. And that is going to hurt people at the kitchen table. If it's going to hurt people's ability to buy homes or invest in their small businesses or a whole host of things, what it means in the real world for people is you destabilize the Centers for Disease Control because you take out the top layer of government who are public servants. They aren't political people. They've been there for a long time. They have expertise. And that expertise is what got us through the worst pandemic in 100 years, and what will get us through the Legionnaires' disease that I heard news about the other day, and what will keep us, if they're allowed to do their jobs, from getting the next. So for them, it's a big power game, but for people at home, its impact on their everyday lives is traumatic and dramatic. And so rights, they're not, people aren't upholding, people in power are not upholding their responsibilities or their
Judy Patrick.
So I agree about the testing the limits and trying to accumulate as much power as possible. I mean, and the Trump administration just could wait until May when Jerome Powell's term expires and they'll be in control. But they want to make the case at this point. You know, this move towards like the, I think, the imperial presidency, I think Schlesinger is, yeah. is the one who wrote the book on that, goes back to Nixon and Eisenhower. So the accumulation of power through executive orders. But, you know, executive orders often are only worth the paper they're mm-hmm. written on. You know, we talk about the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the CDC. You know, I tended to view, when I was a reporter, these as the boring agencies that you don't want to be the flack for because you never get any calls because nobody's really that interested, because oftentimes they're just so driven by numbers. And, you know, it's not, there's not a lot of, it's so objective about, you know, when you're run by doctors, they tend to be pretty objective, although now I have, you know, you've discovered that there's plenty of wiggle room in numbers. And so I think that, you know, when we talk about balancing power, the system has gotten so complex with, you know, competing case law, with moves by Congress to control spending. I often go back to my, when I used to cover the city, when a strong mayor form of government, in a strong mayor form of government, the mayor doesn't have to spend all the money the council allocates. And so the president's doing much the same when he decides not to spend this money that the Congress allocates. So I think it's a real conversation we have about how strong we want our president to be, and almost take Trump out of the equation. We're worried about it because Trump exhibits such dictatorship-like tendencies, but maybe we do really want a very strong president.
But the data is, it may sound boring, but the data is what drives policy, right? The data, I mean, if you look at one of the four people that's out of CDC now, she oversees the data. The data is what you look through to track the spread of disease and how you identify it and how you see if what you're doing is working and how you stop it. The data at the Fed, I mean, that's critical for all sorts of entities to do what they do, to have a common set of numbers that can be trusted. And as somebody was saying last night, the difference between us and Argentina, right, is it's that we don't mess with the Fed. It's apolitical. And if you do, you end up with hyperinflation. You end up with other countries that don't want to invest. You end up because you don't trust the dollar. And so the data is our currency. And of what, you know, it's just, it's the basic functions of government. And that's what the Trump administration is not doing. You see it in a lot of different directions. They're not doing the basic work of governing, which includes working with the Congress, working out the differences, finding out where the common ground is, finding out where what directions we should go in. But they're dismantling these key components that make our government work.
That was Teresa Bourgeois on the Roundtable panel on Friday, August 29th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.